Good afternoon, everyone. This is host Terry Lynn Coop with a special lunchtime edition of the Blue Plate Special. Today's guest thought he could run, but he couldn't hide. I finally got the net over him, and I am thrilled to serve up New York Times bestselling author Chuck Wendig. His books have been called compulsively readable, the kind of caramel corn book you just keep stuffing in your face until it's gone. He's been compared with Thomas Harris, and he is the author of the Miriam Black Thriller series, Atlanta Burns, Heartland YA, which introduced corn punk and other words, and most recently, Invasive and the incredible Aftermath Star Wars tie-in series. How you doing today, Mr. Wendig?
I'm good. How are you?
I am great, and thank you so much for coming on. I've been really looking forward to this.
Oh, my God. No, I'm excited. Thank you for having me. We've known each other online for a while, so it's cool to actually get to, like, you know, sit and talk.
I know. I've missed you at two or three conventions, and it's like, oh, no, this has got to be changed. So you were immediately on my list when I took over this show.
Well, I appreciate
that. Start out with some of the most recent work. You have been called the guy who ruined Star Wars for the original fans with your Aftermath, your Aftermath series.
I've had a few emails that were of that vein. Yeah, some very unkind reviews on Amazon. Generally, it's been super positive. I've been the fan base is by and large pretty awesome, especially the ones I meet at cons and conventions. But there's definitely some people who are not a fan of my work for a number of reasons, some fair and some maybe less so.
Oh, no, definitely less so. The books are fantastic. Why don't you tell us a little bit about when does Aftermath happen?
Aftermath happens, it's set right after the end, literally as the end of Return of the Jedi happens, when they start bringing down the Emperor Palpatine statue. It picks up right from that. And it kind of assumes that now that the rebellion is over, the real war will begin. So Aftermath takes basically the fall of the Galactic Empire and the rise of the New Republic. It tells that story, and it leads all the way up to the Battle of Jakku, which is the planet, of course, that we see Rey on in The Force Awakens. And so it explains how all those ships are there and how they're crashed. They get to crash all those ships. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, that's cool, because that was going to be the next question, is where did it – so it kind of bridges that gap between Jedi and The Force Awakens.
It starts to build the bridge, yeah. I mean, it literally only gets like a year out from Return of the Jedi, and there's another, I think, 29 years that are yet uncovered between those two films. But, yeah, it starts to build the bridge.
And as a dyed-in-the-wool Star Wars geek, I can say when it originally came out, when A New Hope came out, and I saw it with my boyfriend 17 times.
Yeah.
We lived in an extremely small town in Northern California, population about 1,500. And it was kind of like Tom would call me and it was like, what do you want to do? I don't know. What do you want to do? I don't know. You want to go see Star Wars again? Okay. And that's,
yeah, I'd still do that today. Right now, I would go see Star Wars right now.
and really, it was I always tell people that I dated a 1971 Challenger that had a guy named Tom that drove it. So I was like, sure, I'll go to Star Wars with you. But it turned me into a lifelong geek. And I'm thrilled to see the universe continue to expand and evolve. There's room in it. And part of the reason that the, you know, 10 million fanboys cried out in anguish is you diversified the universe.
Yeah. Yeah, I included people who had not traditionally been a part of the Star Wars universe. A few instances before that, but not a lot. And it's, you know, and the films are doing that too. I think Star Wars in general, as a story world, is a good place to lead the way on some of that stuff. So getting those things in there, I found, you know, and some of that comes from experiences I have going to Comic Con, like San Diego or New York Comic Con, and specifically New York Comic Con, and I was there with. Hanging out with an author who actually did the original covers to the Miriam Black series, Joey Hi-Fi, aka Dale Halverson. And he was pointing out quite correctly that most of the audience there who were buying all of these, all the swag, and they were watching all the panels and excited about all the shows, they were an incredibly diverse audience really there for non-diverse pop culture. They were basically consuming a lot of stuff that wasn't really talking directly to them. It was talking kind of over their heads or past them. And so, you know, I think there's so much value in trying to just be that story tells stories to a broader audience.
And that's great. I mean, that you know, Gene Roddenberry paved the way with that of you know, the, oh my God, shock of a black woman on the bridge, that type of thing. You know, those were those first steps. And Star Wars keeps going on that. So are there going to be any more Star Wars novels?
From me or in general?
From you
in general,
specific.
I'm sure there'll be plenty. For me, I have no plans as yet, but I do have a story in the upcoming 40th anniversary anthology, which is called From a Certain Point of View. It's a lot of really cool authors from across the spectrum, the best-selling spectrum, and young adult, and columnists like Mallory Ortberg, and you've got Will Wheaton and Daniel Jose Older. It's great. Good crowd in there. So it's like 40 stories taking place over the course of the first film, A New Hope, and it takes like some of this sort of fringy side characters and gives them a short story. So it's sort of just different perspectives on the movie. Yeah. So it's really cool. I'm excited about it.
I saw the anthology, and I wondered what that premise is. Now that totally makes me want to read it because
40th anniversary. I'm so excited.
Expanding on New Hope, because that was one of those points in movie history where things just changed.
Yeah.
With New Hope. So, I've known you. I've followed you since the Miriam Black series. That's when I came to you.
The things you've seen.
The things I've seen on your back in the Wild West days of your blog, Terrible Minds. How long have you been blogging?
I think it's still the Wild West days. Yeah. What's that?
How long have you been? How long has Terrible Minds been a thing?
At this point, over 10 years. I started the blog as a 15, over 15.
Wow.
I think it was 2001. I think it came out. So 16 years now. Yeah, it started as like a static HTML thing my roommate designed, and it had no metric forums. I had no comments. I couldn't see who was visiting. It was just me ranting about me to me. And as it turned out, there were some people who were actually paying attention, which was, you know, nice. And so when I eventually moved to WordPress, he suddenly was like, oh, there's people here. It's like opening the door and realizing there's a lot of people staring in your house for a while. It's kind of weird.
Well, we'd been surrounding the house, looking in the windows, but your wife kept closing the curtains, so you didn't know we were there.
Yeah, I know. Now we know. Now I know. And now it's weird. It's extra weird.
It got awkward. We were making a mess in the garden and everything.
Okay.
No, you had... And this is one of those things, too, where people start blogs and that sort of thing, and they don't realize the work that has to go into them. I mean, you are that classic 15-year overnight success.
Yeah, yeah. Everyone who asks me advice about blogging now, and I'm like, well, go back in time 10 years and start a blog. That's my best advice for you.
I do it occasionally, mainly just like you said, when I have some sort of a rant that I feel is necessary, or I want something that's easy to link to, or I can just say, here, I'm tired of answering that question. Go here.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And here is where all will be revealed at this link, because I've already answered that question 10 times today and I don't want to anymore. But no, you've managed to create an amazing community on Terrible Minds, and that led to your series of what I've always called the fount of dubious writing advice, which is your pen monkey.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely very dubious and definitely a fountain.
But no, they were fabulous, because I've read quite a few of them, and you actually did in more than one time jolt me out of an inertia that I was in.
Well, thank you. That's like kind of part of the goal for me for writing advice, that it's not necessarily there to tell you what to do so much as it's there to sort of give you ideas and to jar you free of things. Like, you know, I tell a story where Blackbird took me like 5 years to write, and the only thing that solved writing it, and you like, I even the 5 years I couldn't even finish it. I just kept trying and kept. I was like a person lost at the mall, not sure why they were there. Like I walked into a bookstore and forgot the book I wanted to buy. So, you know, the thing that jarred me out of that was, I guess, like every aspiring novelist, I won a screenwriting competition, and in doing that, I won a year-long mentorship with a screenwriter, and part of my little cheat goal was, like, I wanted him to teach me how to adapt material so I could adapt my own piece of crap novel to a screenplay, and then I could see the scope of it and rewrite it as an official novel. And one of the first things he told me was, like, well, you need to outline this. And I said, no, I don't do that. I don't know if you know how, like, novelists work. But we listen to the grass and the clouds. We don't outline things. And he said, no, you need to outline. That's, like, the first step. So, you know, I did my, you know, punch frozen beef, and I bit the belt, and I did whatever the training montage needed to be at that time. And I ended up, you know, over the course of 2 days, anguished days, I wrote an outline. The next thing I knew, I that was the book. Like, I mean, it wasn't complete. It was only 2 pages, but I had a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it told a story. And so I was able to take that right into a screenplay, right into a book, and there it was. And the lesson from that is not that you should outline. The lesson is my process wasn't working, so I needed something to change my process. So, you know, some people outline forever and they can never get that to work. So maybe you don't need to. Maybe you need to go freeform with it and sort of loosen yourself from that. The goal is not necessarily to do the one true thing, but the goal is to stop accepting that your way is the one true thing.
Yes. The books, the Pen Monkey books are absolutely hilarious. That's when your
thank you.
Writing style was a little more florid, shall we say?
Yeah. Sure, we'll go with that. Yeah, used a lot of interesting language. Sure.
But they are hilarious, and that's what they're good for. Anyone who's listening who needs that kick in the pants, I highly recommend go hunting them up. There'll be 250 ways to do this or 500 ways to do that, and they're fabulous. They're great reading, and you will pull nuggets of advice out of them that'll help you along. What pried my first novel out of me was changing it over to first person.
That change and it, like, unlocks it, right?
That's exactly what it needed. And then on top of it, I gave my character a little dog, because she does spend a fair amount of time alone early on in the book, and I basically gave her Wilson the volleyball to talk to.
Yeah, little things like that, just that change suddenly, that's awesome.
And because it got, you know, the typical stuff, too much internal dialogue, all that, and it's like I just gave her a dog to talk to. So, and that's where you hit it, and you keep going over and over in your blog, is like you said, you know, don't be afraid to change something and see if it works. So what dark recesses did Marion Black come out of? Tell us a little bit about Marion Black for the people who may not, the 5 or 10 slackers out there who haven't read it yet.
Oh, I sadly think there's more than 5 or 10. So if we can talk to everybody, read it. No, Marion Black is a character who can see how you're going to die by touching you, which clearly does not do good things for her psychological state. I often refer to her as a garage full of cats on fire, mentally and emotionally. And, you know, that it's sort of a story that takes, you know, her with this frustrating power of seeing how people are going to die, but not being able to change that. And then taking her through the journey of how she learns that she can change that, how she can move fate. And really, it comes out of a basic fundamental dark recess, I think one most people sort of get to, which is the realization that people die. Like when you're a teenager, like you do stupid stuff because you're not necessarily keen on that reality. You know, you mix Coca-Cola and Pop Rocks, you do those risky things. or you do methamphetamine and jump out of a plane. Whatever it is you're into as a teenager, you know, that's on you.
Yes.
So you do stupid stuff, and then people around you, maybe your grandparents start to die. You know, my case, as I got older, not only did I have grandparents die, but I had an aunt who passed away. I had my dad who passed away. And you start to realize not only that are other people going to die, but you too also are going to die. And so, you know, it's just like a mortality assault on all levels. So, you know, I wanted to sort of confront that with kind of this twisted power fantasy. So Miriam isn't necessarily a character who can easily do something about that. She does have the ability, but it's like, you know, moving mountains. It's a sacrificial ability. It's not necessarily something that's super heroic. So it was kind of a fun way to explore death and to feel more comfortable with it in a grotesque kind of face forward way.
Well, and you start her out, the first book, I love it, where she will brush up against you, see how you're going to die, and then be there to steal your stuff when it happens.
Yeah, she'll rob you. She'll rob you blind.
That was so amazing to read in the first book. It was just like...
Thank you.
Well,
yeah, I think like, if you're that broken by it and you can't feel like you can change it, you know, I think she's kind of using it. She's kind of a grifter then. And then it changes
definitely.
The scope of what happens when she learns that she does have the ability to do something, and suddenly she's been grifting people this whole time, and it requires a pretty serious shift in her character.
And I will say, too, for both the first edition and the second edition, the Marion Black books have some of the most beautiful covers I have ever seen.
Yeah, I've won the cover lottery repeatedly with a lot of my books. I've been very lucky on the cover department.
Yes, the Aftermath books are beautiful, too, but particularly Joey Hi-Fi's work.
Yeah, the Joey Hi-Fi work for the Marion Black series and the Mookie Pearl series, and now the Marion Black series has an artist, Adam Doyle.
Mm-hmm.
His work is great, and his very painterly sort of, you know, creepy birds in repose and in attack mode. It's great. It's awesome.
And now, what the hell was Heartland and the Heartland trilogy and this corn thing?
Yeah,
living in the Midwest, that bothered me more than it should.
The Heartland was kind of like an inadvertent test run for Star Wars. John Horner Jacobs, the author, who's a great author, like I wish I aspire to his talent. He blurbed the book and said it was like Star Wars meets John Steinbeck, and I was like, ooh, that's a good sales line. I wish I had thought of that.
Wow.
So you know that. So when it came time to actually get the Star Wars job, which came from me tweeting of all things, my first sort of interview with the editor was, she's like, well, I read your books. And so I said, well, that was good to meet you. Then I guess you don't want to hire me for Star Wars. She said, no, I read the good books. I read the ones that are like Star Wars, not Marion Black. And it turns out she read the Heartland series and found that was appropriately very Star Wars-ish. So, from Cornpunk to, the galaxy far, far away.
And I can actually see that when I didn't make the connection when I was reading them, but I can actually see that now. I mean, that was one twisted trilogy, and it just kept getting twistier and twistier.
Yeah, thank you. It was a lot of fun to just keep sort of bending it back on itself and taking these characters. That's one of the great things about being able to tell a longer form story is, you know, having these characters and introducing them at sort of a point A and then taking them through B's through Z and just seeing where you keep kind of putting bends in the pipe and changing their lives and changing them as a result.
A couple of years ago, I was driving up to Milwaukee, and it was right before the harvest. And so here I am driving through these, you know, countless square miles of nothing but tall corn, you know, in the wind. It was like watching wind on water. That's how dense the
corn has a creepy thing.
Was. And it just, between you and Stephen King, I just was like skeeved out the whole trip. I want to thank you for that.
Yeah, I apologize, also you're welcome. Yeah.
Had a kid jumped out of one of those fields at any time and thrown himself in front of my car, I just would have kept right on driving. Because
that's fair. That's probably
that's
the best choice.
Nothing was going to come good from this. So that brings me up, talking about creepy, why don't you tell us a little about Invasive?
Oh, yeah, Invasive. Invasive is a book about... a character named Hannah Stander, who is a futurist, a consultant for the FBI. She's a futurist. In other words, it's her job to sort of imagine bizarre scenarios, real world, you know, cutting edge, bleeding edge technology scenarios that the FBI isn't considering. You know, like years ago, it might have been, hey, did you know people might fly planes into buildings? And that was something that wasn't necessarily on everybody's radar. In this case, it's about genetically modified ants. Being used as a weapon in this case, and it sort of posits the person who designs them and controls them as sort of a serial killer, using these ants to kind of hurt people for reasons unknown. And so it takes her to a Hawaiian island and then to a sort of forbidden atoll where these ants are loose, and she has to not only deal with them but solve the mystery of why they exist and who is controlling them. It's a lot of good, grim, squeaky fun.
On that one, you got compared to Michael Crichton quite a bit.
Yeah, Michael Crichton was a good, and I was, you know, kind of aiming for that for a point. I sort of was like, you know, I wanted to tell my version of that kind of thriller, and see what that was like. And it's set in the same world as the book prior to it, which is Zeros. It's not a sequel to it because it doesn't really contain the same characters, though it does contain a few crossover bits. But the stories are entirely different, but they are set in worlds where, like, Invasive takes place in a world where Zeros, the events of Zeros, has happened. So they are loosely connected.
Expand on that. How did Zeros lead into it? Basically, tell us a little bit about Zeros.
Yeah, Zeros is about a group of hackers who get from all walks of life. Because hackers are often portrayed as sort of one type of thing, which is like the moody loner in a hoodie. And they sort of wanted to deal with white hat hackers and black hat hackers and hackers who were political and hackers who were trolls. And they all get caught and scooped up and are forced to work together from this kind of government agency, the NSA, who they then discover has actually created an artificial intelligence. And they uncover the artificial intelligence and then escape the government and basically need to hack the artificial intelligence before it takes everything over. So some of the characters in that, specifically one of the guys, Hollis Copper, who brings the hackers together, he's also the one who interfaces with Hannah Stander in Invasive. So he's sort of one of the common threads between those two things.
Gotcha. I didn't pick that up. So that's cool. I'll revisit that. And one thing that Jonathan Mayberry told me on these sort of like we were talking specifically with his on the Joe Ledger is what makes them work is you set up a scenario where whatever happens seems plausible.
Yes. It has to be believable. You have to sell it as a real thing, even if it's not real. People have to believe it's real or it becomes schlocky and pulpy.
Or that it could happen. Like we all, you know, we went further into that conversation and I realized that's what made X-Files so enjoyable. They set it up in such a way where if I read tomorrow in the newspaper that they'd found a giant fluke man in the, you know, in the sewer system, I'd go, well, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I believe that.
Yeah, and then we elected the fluke man president.
Oh, please.
Whoops.
Well, going through your, the breadth and the width and the breadth of your writing and what you've gotten into has really been amazing over the last few years.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. The goal is always to sort of tell a Chuck Wendig story, even if they're across different genres. I wanted them to feel like stories I've written, even if they're wildly different from each other.
Because you started out, I mean, that's, you know, you'd obviously written quite a bit before, but you kind of hit with the Marion Black series. And that seems like it's pretty, that would be shelved in what, urban fantasy?
Well, that's one of those things that proves that genre is just a thing people made up. Like, it's not a science, it's not an equation. Because originally, I sold it to my agent as, I think, kind of like horror and crime, which is really ostensibly how I aim to write them. They're scary horror novels written with a crime novel thrust. And then, you know, the publisher who picked them up originally, Angry Robot, sold them as urban fantasy, which is not entirely inaccurate, though there's nothing urban about them. They're set mostly rural. They're not particularly fantastic. They're more, you know, it's more paranormal than it is fantasy. But okay, so then they had it for a while, and then when they lost the rights to it, and then a new publisher picked them up, Simon & Schuster Saga, they wanted to sell them as supernatural suspense. Because, of course, no one sells horror. You can't label anything horror. It's like kind of anathema. Like even Joe Hill, Stephen King's son, gets labeled as supernatural suspense or supernatural thriller. So that's where they're at now. So supernatural suspense, supernatural thriller.
Well, when I was thinking of them, there's another series by Stacia Kane, the Downtown Magic series, where she basically, her main character is a witch, but she has kind of a Miriam Black vibe. I was just thinking that, you know, that hard-edged, hard-bitten, hard-driven, usually
nice
female character that seems to populate so many urban fantasy books. So I think all of the quote unquote labels that you used, I think work. I think the answer is yes.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. And I'm fine with that. If it gets me more readers and crosses different genre boundaries, I'm.
And then of course, Star Wars, you know, classic straight up sci-fi media tie-in.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
To which, To which Jonathan Mayberry called you out as one of the really talented media tie-in writers that are working right now.
Oh, well, that's an honor coming from probably one of the most talented media tie-in writers out there.
And then you come in with this, even though they're not a series, but this Zero Invasive, which is straight up kind of techno futuristic techno thriller.
Yeah, techno thriller, near future. But see, here's the trick, and I kind of hinted at it with Blackbirds. Is at the end of the day, most of the books I write are horror novels. I don't really sell them as horror novels, but they're ultimately horror novels. I grew up reading horror. I grew up loving horror. Like Jonathan Mayberry, even though his books are not necessarily called quote-unquote horror, I write horror novels. Scary stuff, The Answer, Scary Monsters, The Artificial Intelligence is a body horror monster who uses people as literal computers in Zeros. I mean, there's all kinds of scary stuff. I want to write sort of scary stories, even if I can't call them scary stories. Star Wars obviously gets away from that a little bit because I just love Star Wars so darn much.
In a segue alert, what are you working on now?
I am working on a big, it's like 182,000 words as of today, a novel called Exeunt, which is about sort of I don't want to spoil too much. One day a young girl wakes up and finds that her little sister, her 13-year-old sister, has woken up out of her bed and is walking down the street almost as if a sleepwalker, and she can't be awakened, and she can't be stopped. If you try to stop her, she begins to shudder, and her temperature rockets up to unnatural heights. Mm-hmm. And about an hour later, another walker joins her, and about every couple hours, someone else joins the flock. And it's sort of getting this inciting incident is the question of why are they walking, and what does it mean, and where are they going? And it's a rather epic sort of horror novel, science fiction novel in the vein of Station 11 meets The Stand that sort of takes you through this countrywide journey with these characters.
That's got a little touch of The Cell in it too.
Oh, I can see that King, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah,
like you
an
said,
interesting take on zombies. Yeah.
Where people just like you said, they just pick up and they just start walking.
Yep.
And the story behind it. So that one is still on the drawing board, correct? Or on the that one's
yeah,
still in your hard
still
drive?
Yeah, still being written. Yeah, first draft still going. Biggest book I've ever written so far.
And is it a standalone or is it going to be a series?
Well, it is presently a standalone. I do technically have a 2-book deal on it, so it is always possible that if this thing just gets too big and too nutty, that we could chop it in half. There is a point in the middle where it kind of serves as sort of an end of the one kind of arc, so to speak, where you kind of get to the next thing. So there's always that possibility, but at present it remains a standalone novel.
Oh, to have that problem of too many words. You've just got,
I know.
I mean, does your wife at the end of the day with a broom and a dustpan and scoop up all the excess words you didn't use, the ones that just fell on the floor?
No, I hoard them. I don't, yeah, no one else can have them. I keep them. I put them in drawers and hide them. I never know when I might need them.
Well, one thing, and I've teased about that this year, is you've always had the motto of finish your shit.
Yeah, that's key. Because you never learn if you don't do that. You can't get that. You have to get there.
And I took that. I'm taking that to heart this year. That was my goal for this year, is to basically go through and finish all of the anything that had any meat on the bone, that wasn't just where I'd maybe knocked off a half a page of notes on my in a Word file, but anything that I had started to actually get it finished this year. And I don't know if I'm going to quite make it, but I'm going to come awfully close to it. So thank you for that. And I know you've talked about that on the blog. Where does that come from? Just that finish your shit.
Well, it comes from deadlines. Like when I first, when I left college, I did a number of bizarre jobs, and it would, we could literally fill a half an hour with the bizarre jobs that I had. And none of them were good. All of them were bad. And none of them were really what I wanted to do. And I knew I wanted to be a writer. And so I took a job. I always had grown up with pen and paper role-playing games, like D&D type stuff. And one such company was hiring. And so I did sort of a pretentious essay to get hired. It turns out they liked pretentious essays. So they did hire me. But part of the deal was, to keep getting hired, they always say you have to be either fast, friendly, or good. And so you have to be two of those three things. So I aimed for fast and friendly. So I didn't know if I was good, but I knew I could be quick, and I knew I could be nice about it. And both of those things, you know, I turned in a lot of work very quickly. And so that was part of the thing. Like, I don't get paid if I don't finish. And so being a freelance writer really taught me the value of deadlines and the value of getting it done and then moving on to the next thing.
So what kind of stuff were you writing in your fast and friendly days?
Well, it was all game stuff back then. Like, I was writing novels, but they were terrible. They were me sort of chasing some version of a novel that I thought the market wanted or that I thought I could be. It was aping people's voice stuff, never really doing my own thing. But so it was good to sort of get past that. But that took years. That took literally, like, you know, 15 years to sort of figure that out.
Yes, you are the absolute poster child for the 15-year overnight success.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the giant iceberg that floats beneath the peak of my actual career.
Because you did some self-publishing back in the day, correct?
Yeah. At the same time that I had the Miriam Black series get picked up, I released a short story collection, and then obviously some writing advice books and stuff. Sure.
And how was that experience? Is it something you recommend?
Well, I do recommend it just because, first of all, it gives you some measure of control over the work, and it gives you a sense of, like, do I like to do this? You know, is this something I can do? Is this something interesting? You learn a lot about the publishing process by doing it yourself. That being said, I don't do it too often now, in part just because I don't have the time, which is, again, a good problem to have. And I do find that I've been more successful on the actual traditional publishing side of things. And some people have different experiences with that, and that plays, I think, to different strengths and to what people can do and what they like.
Definitely, definitely. And so what is a day in the life of Chuck Wendig?
Oh, boy. Well, I roll out of my Ferrari and I kick all the Dom Perignon bottles out, and then I get on my yacht and come home. No, I have a shed in the woods. I literally had people build the shed for me in the woods because I can't build it. People are like, you built the shed? I'm like, no, I write books. I don't build things. So I have a shed literally that I walk outside, and it's tucked away in the woods from the house. So it's like a 2-minute walk, my shed. And it has heating and air conditioning, and it has my computer and Wi-Fi. And I that's usually after my son goes to school. I'm out here, and I write until I am done for the day. And then I do whatever else I need to do to get the stuff done.
Yes, I remember the great controversy over when the shed was being built, and where it's like, okay, build Chuck's shed. Where are the suggestions to do that? But it sounds like it's definitely worked for you, because that's one thing, particularly people with families, is you need a place to work.
Yeah, you really do.
Because I'm here, I write, and then I also took over the family's antique business after my husband passed away. So basically, I live in my business, and I can never escape it. And that's sometimes one of the things that kind of gets me down sometimes, is there's always a pile of work everywhere I turn around.
Yeah, it never stops.
So you've developed the kind of the punch in the time clock a little bit thing out in the, and then when the Chuck shed is shut for the day, you're off work.
Then I'm out. Yeah. You know, it's good and bad. It's good in that it creates for me clear boundaries. So when I go in to, you know, for dinner or whatever, to make dinner and do the rest of the thing, like, I'm not checking email, I'm not doing any of that stuff. But it does also mean, you know, sometimes, like, people are like, can you do a, you know, a podcast, or can we bouncing the emails late at night? Why are you responding? I'm like, aren't you a writer? You have nothing else to do. So, yeah, no, I've turned everything off. That's been part of the deal with the shed, was it allows me to sort of compartmentalize the
and
writing
absolutely.
Life. Otherwise, it would take me over.
And when you told me that, that's why we're doing the lunchtime edition, which I think is great, because you've definitely as you've developed your finish your shit mentality, you've also developed the right boundaries and compartments.
Yeah, I didn't have those for the first like 10 years of my writing career. I was constantly working. Good in the sense that it helped me build up stuff. But I mean, now that I'm older with family and stuff, I gotta be smart.
Absolutely. We love your stuff about B-Dub.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Yeah, he's a good kid.
He's an awesome kid. And it looks like he's starting to try and turn into a little artist here.
Oh man, yeah, every night he's glued to his little drawing table. Yeah. Which is cool.
Well,
I love
and
it. I'm, you know.
oh, that's fantastic. And you can there again, finish your shit. You can share some of your wisdom there with him too, and help him
Yeah.
develop some of the discipline early on that it takes to do this thing we do.
Yeah, because it's hard, you know. It's like you do this thing and you're like, why am I not immediately awesome at it? And then you give up. You know, like, well, to get awesome at something, you often have to be very bad at it first. And that's a really hard thing to explain, especially to kids, but it's hard even for adults to sort of get that.
I have my requisite three novels stuck in the dustiest recesses of my
Oh,
hard
yeah.
drive that will never see the
Yeah.
light of day.
I've got five that should be literally buried in a, like, then they say trunk novel, like mine should be in a lead line trunk buried in the backyard, lest they cause an airborne toxic event.
And I asked John Gilstrap about that one day. He was talking about his trunkers, and I asked him if they were ever going to see the light of day. And he said, well, in some ways they actually have, because he'll go in and he'll mine a character, or he'll mine a scene or something out of them and actually use them in a book that's good.
Yeah.
So do you
Yep,
ever
yep,
do
yep.
that? Do you ever go back to the old days and go, you didn't
Kind of
look at a
mined a few
character and go, you
ideas
didn't
here and there.
suck. Yeah, you didn't
Yeah.
suck completely, so you can come out
Yeah,
now.
once in a while.
The
Yep.
rest of you suck. So you stay.
Yeah. Well, actually, yeah, Miriam is from one of my first novels. Just as a, not the power, but the attitude. I mean, the name Miriam came from it. Like, I enjoyed writing her. The book was terrible that I wrote with her in it. She wasn't even the protagonist. She was just a side character at that point. So yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you find stuff. You find ways to bring things back.
So where might we see you out on the con circuit?
Well, I'll be doing New York Comic Con, and then I will be going to do a short West Coast tour in support of my next writing book, which comes out next month. The writing book is called Damn Fine Story. It's actually not a writing book so much as it is a book about storytelling and about sort of picking apart sort of narrative and figuring out how to really be impactful with your character choices and you're letting plot flow from the characters instead of vice versa. So I'll be doing 3 dates there with authors Kevin Hearn and Fran Wild, and we'll be in San Francisco on the 17th, Portland on the 18th, and Seattle on the 19th.
One of the questions I got from readers was, I'm supposed to ask you why you think Kevin Hearn is a great guy.
Because he is. He's the nicest guy that I have. He's just one of the nicest. Like, writers in general, I actually find are pretty great people. I think there's sometimes people think they're a bunch of lunatics or whatever, but writers are generally pretty cool. I always enjoy going to cons and hanging out with writers. I always have good luck with that. You know, we're kind of a slapdash kooky bunch, but I think once you sort of get past that, we're generally fun to hang around and good people. And Kevin is like the pinnacle of good people. He's constantly doing everything for other people, and he deserves all the great kudos that he gets for both his demeanor and his work, which is great.
Hey, lunatic and nice are not mutually exclusive.
No, as I said, it's pretty much the writer thing, the writer jam.
We prove it
We're all
every
nice, cuckoo
cuckoo
banana
day.
fans people. Yeah.
Are you going to BoucherCon or any of the other bigger shows
No,
in the
BoucherCon.
foreseeable?
Mostly I stick to. Yeah, I stick to Comic Cons and stuff. I'm going doing RavenCon later in the year, but that's a bit of the ways away. New York Comic Con is my biggest show coming up, I think.
And when is that?
That is October, cough cough, 7th, I think, the weekend of the 7th.
Oh, that's going to be a blast. A friend of mine just posted that he got his badge, and evidently this year they're sending him out. They're not putting New York Comic Con in the return
I thought
address.
that was Rob. Yeah, Rob Hart.
That was
Yeah.
Rob.
Yeah, they do. They used to do that. They used to send them out, and like, especially in New York, people knew what they were, and they just pop them out of the envelopes and steal them from you.
That's awesome. I can see this ring of thieving postmen.
Oh
You
my
know,
God! Yeah,
dealing
because they close it off. Like, once they only allow so many people in. So yeah,
in black market Comic-Con badges.
right. Exactly. Illicit.
That's a fascinating world, because I actually got my start collecting and into this geek thing in comic books. So I've been to tons of Comic-Cons, and that's just a great world too. Just such excellent people. I mean, you run across a self-entitled asshole every once in a while, but most of them are just incredibly fabulous. or Dan Jurgens stayed, you know, for like 2 hours after his signing because he just couldn't believe people wanted his autograph.
I know, it's exciting, yeah. Yeah, and Comic-Cons now are just all about pop culture in general, so you get such a wide variety of different types of stories and different types of industries. It's very cool.
Well, that is excellent. So, will I see you back when this epic and magnum opus hits real life?
Oh, Exune, yeah. Yeah, that comes out this coming August, so about a year. So, yeah, I'll be back on, sure.
Definitely, definitely. This has been so much fun and so great to finally talk to you after knowing you online for so long.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And anytime, and you are welcome back anytime. If there's something interesting going on or whatever, just drop me a line and you are welcome back anytime.
Sold. Thank you.
And my final question that I always try and ask too is, it's time to rat out one of your friends. Who are you reading?
Who am I reading right now? I'm reading, he's not a friend of mine. There's a novel called Meddling Kids by Edgar Cantero. Is that his name? Edgar Cantero? Let me look that up real quick. Edgar Cantero, I did get that right. And it's sort of like a grown-up Scooby-Doo. Like, they're literally a Scooby-Doo type of crime. I mean, there's literally even a dog. It doesn't talk, but there's a dog. And it assumes that they were these, like, you know, gang of young middle grade detective solving mysteries and pulling masks off, you know, old man Withers. And they found one case back then that they really couldn't solve, and they're trying to solve it now. And it's like very Lovecraftian because there's clearly something actually supernatural going on, which they have resisted believing in. So it's just this weird pop culture fun mashup of good stuff.
That sounds like a hoot, an absolute hoot. And what was the name of that again? Meddling Kids?
That is Meddling Kids, yeah.
Well, that sounds great. Well, thank you for spending your lunchtime with us, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
All right. Take care, and stop by next Friday when I talk to John McGoran about his new novel, Spliced, which is actually right up Chuck's alley.
I just got a copy of it. I'm so excited. John's a great dude.
Yes,
I'm
it is. I've got a copy of it sitting here, and I can't wait. I'm actually going to be talking to him on Friday the 29th, which is when the book drops. So that'll be
nice.
a fun one to tune into. And
I will
say good afternoon to you. I've got a couple little housekeeping announcements to make, and then we are ready to rock and roll. Thanks a lot,
cool.
Chuck. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Hi, bye-bye.
And for all you folks out there listening, this broadcast is owned and copyrighted by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, and we will see you next Friday. Thank you much. Take care now.